This is episode 95 of The Variety Artist. This is John Abrams, your host, and that guy that interviews successful variety artists from around the world every single week. It's almost here. I've been working super hard on creating the Variety Artist Shop. Pretty soon, you'll be able to get your favorite quotes from some of your favorite variety artist guests on mugs, t-shirts, and all sorts of swag. You can see some samples of some teas on the Variety Artist Community Facebook page. Just waiting for a couple more samples, and I'll be opening it up. Watch for the announcement. Or listen. Either way. All right. I learned a bunch on the show today. Today, you'll find out how the circus began, where the crystal ball came from, why magicians are so interested in the supernatural, and some great ghost stories. Enjoy the show!
Fun fact number 429. John and his friends ran around the beach at night in togas made of seaweed.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He was twice voted Parlor Magician of the Year by the world-famous Magic Castle in Hollywood. He brings more than 40 years of comedy and magic experience to the stage. He's the author of many books, including Haunted Cemeteries, Haunted Theaters, Haunted Highways, and many more. You can put his name in the search bar at Amazon and check out his books there. Variety Artist, I give you Tom Ogden.
Hi, John.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm darn near perfect, but the day's early.
It is early. Imagine what you're going to be like later on in the day.
Oh, my.
All right, well, before we start, it seems like you have two different careers, the comedy magic career and then the ghost speaking career. Is that right?
Yes, and one grew directly out of the other.
Let's start with the comedy magic. How did that all start?
Well, when I was a boy, back in the 1920s, there were a lot of variety acts on television back then. You know, Ed Sullivan was still on TV.
Mm.
Talk shows still used variety acts that weren't on to plug a movie or film, you know, or whatever. So I saw a lot of magicians on TV. It was the Saturday morning kids shows, which today are all animated cartoons. Mm. But back then they were variety acts. They would be puppeteers, or it would be like Mark Wilson's Alakazam show, which was magic show, or Bozo the Clown, which would use circus type acts, including magicians. Growing up in that era in the 60s, and God help me, even in the 50s when I was pre-teenager, you know, that was where you saw variety acts, which got me interested. As a matter of fact, before magic, I was a puppeteer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, I started in hand puppetry. Mm-hmm. Because Kukla, Fran, and Ollie and other puppeteers, Topo Gigio and Ed Sullivan, were there, and I wanted to do that. Then the wave of ventriloquists came on TV. Mm-hmm. Shari Lewis, Paul Winchell, Jimmy Nelson. I decided I wanted to learn that, and I did. The man who taught me ventriloquism, who was my high school music teacher at school, also was an amateur magician.
Okay.
We met for a half hour once a week. We would work on one particular part of ventriloquism, like learning to say a word with a P in it without moving your lips.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a good lesson, he would show me a magic trick. He wouldn't tell me how it was done, but he would tell me what book it was in the library. Because he knew that if I just learned the secret, I wouldn't put in the work to practice and learn it. It was actually a great way to teach me magic, because it may be one trick in the middle of a 300-page book.
Right.
But you had to read the whole book to find that trick.
Well, that makes sense. That's how I learned originally, is through books at the library. That seemed to be the easiest way, or for me, the easiest and least expensive way to learn my craft.
And by the way, you kids listening in here, you kids, that still is the best way.
I, It's true. You know, if you go on YouTube and you see how a trick is done, a lot of times you won't do that trick because you're like, well, I know how it's done now. And it takes a little bit of the magic out of the magic.
The whole video revolution in magic has a good and bad side. The good side is that you see what the trick is actually supposed to look like. The downside is that you wind up mimicking the hand motions or the gestures or even the patter, the words that that particular performer put on tape. Oh. If you're reading a book and it says, curl your left little finger around the inner right hand corner of the deck and draw down three cards, you have to figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
In your own hand. Whereas if you're learning it from a video, your hands are different than that person's hands. So the best way they've figured out how to do it for their hand may not be the best way for your hand.
Now, along with your puppetry, when you started doing puppetry, do you also have some sort of relationship with the circus?
That was my first professional touring. Our form of circus, the American style of circus, is a unique form, different than its predecessors in Europe and Asia.
What do you mean by that? I mean, what's the difference?
Well, for instance, most places around the world are one-ring circuses. It's just a whole different style of performance. Mm-hmm. Like everything American, ours had to be bigger, brassier, the first, the biggest, the loudest. And the American circus, it was a merger between horse exhibitions and traveling zoos.
Oh.
Because zoos didn't exist in communities back in the 1700s and early 1800s. So entrepreneurs would buy or lease an elephant and tour it. So all the people could come out and see the exotic animals. And when those two ideas merged, it formed the basis of the American style of circus.
So what brought you from circus to haunted things?
Well, there were several steps in between.
Okay.
I have a friend, Michael Curlin, who's written 20, 30 books, maybe more. And he's a friend to many magicians. He's not a magician himself, but he has a lot of magician friends. And he had a contract with Facts on File, a publishing house that specialized in one volume encyclopedias on a given topic. Like the Encyclopedia of the Civil War, the Encyclopedia of Automobiles, something like that. And he got a contract to write the Encyclopedia of Magic and Magicians. He couldn't finish it on time because he had another book contract that was due sooner, and he couldn't get them both done on time. So he gave the contract to a mutual friend of ours who had already had a couple of books published. So, of course, I started whining to Michael, saying, well, why didn't you give me the contract? And I said, I have an English degree. Yeah. I could have finally used it. And he said, oh, I didn't know you wanted to write a book. And I said, well, I don't know anything but magic, except I toured with a circus. Do you think they'd want a circus book? And in front of me, Michael says, I don't know. Let's find out. Boop, 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 boop. Hi, he calls his editor. Hi. Have you ever wanted a book on the circus? Oh, you've been wanting one for about 5 years, but haven't found the right guy to write it? I think I found him for you.
All right.
And that's how my first book contract happened.
Okay.
After the circus encyclopedia, I sold them then a book, an encyclopedia of wizards and sorcerers.
Okay.
Which probably would have sold much better post Harry Potter years.
Oh, yeah.
That editor moved on to the Idiot's Guide series.
Oh, okay.
Which is the competition series to the Dummies series.
Right.
Magic for Dummies was coming out. Mm-hmm. My editor said, would you like to do Complete Idiot's Guide to Magic? And of course I did. I had actually suggested it to him earlier and they turned it down. until the competition announced it was going to do a book on the subject.
Yeah.
So I wrote that. I wrote then a follow-up book on specifically on street magic. In between, they said to me, we've decided we want a book, just a general interest book, not an instructional book, not a how-to book, mm-hmm. but just a book about ghosts and hauntings. Mm-hmm. You're a magician. You must know all about ghosts.
Of course, because all of us magicians are professional, you know, ghost hunters, of course.
Of course, we're professional ghost hunters on the side.
Yeah.
And of course, I knew nothing about ghosts. I knew how magicians produce ghosts on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the way the ghosts are made at the Haunted Mansion in Disneyland through magic right. optics. But I said, does it pay in advance against royalties? And they said, yes. I said, I know everything there is to know about ghosts and
haunted. More than anybody.
In the world. And they said, there's only one caveat. We want the serious study of ghosts up front and then the weird wacko haunting stories in the back.
Where did you get all of your information then?
This was not a book on ghost hunting. I wasn't expected to do first-person investigations mm-hmm. for the book. It was definitions. It was famous ghost stories like the Flying Dutchman, all of that. So through books and, of course, then the internet. And as soon as I told my friends or anyone that I was writing a book on ghosts, they would tell me their stories.
Oh.
And that was the fascinating part. I was meeting a cruise ship, and it was my first time in Argentina. It's chaos when you come out of customs and immigration because there's 100 taxi drivers all standing there saying, best price, ride me. And a well-dressed woman who I'd seen on the flight comes over to me and says, you seem a bit overwhelmed. First time in Buenos Aires?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes. She said, I have a driver. Can I drop you off someplace? And I said, sure. Well, on the way to the cruise ship port, I found out her husband worked for the U.S. Embassy.
Yeah.
Well, I guess she told me that before I agreed to get in the car with her. Or maybe not. Anyway, so I told her on the way, I told her what I was doing, and I was working on a book. And I said, and I'm writing a book about ghosts. And she got very quiet and said, I have a ghost. And I'd learned by that point to not ask questions because it would lead them the wrong way. I would just say, tell me about it.
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, my grandmother died and we got her a full-length mirror that used to hang in her hallway. And we put it in our hallway in approximately the same position as you come through the door. She said, and every so often, as I'm passing it, out of the corner of my eye, I think I see my grandmother standing there looking at me from the mirror. And of course, when I turn full face to the mirror, nothing's there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, so what did you do with the mirror? She said, well, I freaked out. She said, I couldn't break it. What if her spirit's actually trapped in there someplace?
Yeah.
But I couldn't keep it hidden. I wouldn't sell it to anyone. I'm not going to sell my grandmother. So they boarded it up and put it in storage.
Wow.
And I assured her that her story was not unique. I said that reflective surfaces have been surmised to be a portal to the spirit world for millennia.
Hmm.
Fortune telling and contacting spirits were first done by looking into either running water like a stream or a bowl of water, and it was called scrying. The solidified form of that became the crystal ball.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous mirror here in Hollywood at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel that Marilyn Monroe's ghost appeared in. And for many years, it was in the lobby of the and then the mezzanine of the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. And I'm told that the real reason it went into storage is because they didn't want weirdo ghost people coming in just to see the mirror.
I wish I would have known that story. I did a show there 25 years ago. I wish I would have known that story, because if that mirror was still there, I'd be one of those strange ghost people that would be looking at the mirror.
Oh,
going,
my goodness. Ooh. It's one of the most haunted places in Hollywood. Montgomery Clift stayed there when he was shooting From Here to Eternity. For the movie, he had to learn to play the bugle. To this day, people in the hallway will call down to the front desk in the middle of the night and say, would you get that whoever's blowing a trumpet over in the room across the hall to shut up? It's 3 a.m.
Still to this day, they get that?
Even when the room's unoccupied, people will see a male figure walking back and forth in the hallway with a script in hand as if running lines. The main ballroom, which was where the first Academy Awards were held, has a male ghost and a cold spot. Or for those who aren't ghost people, a cold spot would be, imagine that you were standing in the middle of a circular spot. It could be anywhere from 3 feet in diameter to five, you know, it's just a spot where there's a temperature drop of about 10 or more degrees from the surrounding. And it's not a breeze. It's not by ventilation. It's just you walk into something and it's as if you're standing in a shaft or a column of coldness. These cold spots are thought by some to be, I hate to use the cliche word, but a portal to the spirit world or an indication that there are ghosts present. So anyway, this is the kind of stuff that I started learning when writing the book. Regardless of my personal beliefs, I just found this subject fascinating.
Well, I think it's fascinating too.
So my editor from the ghost book at the Idiot's Guide made a recommendation to a publishing house in Connecticut who wanted to start a series of books about hauntings with a unique twist. They were books of original fiction, campfire stories that were based on existing legends. So in other words, that Marilyn Mirror, I wrote a story about a Marilyn impersonator on Hollywood Boulevard.
Okay.
Her friend is going to meet her in the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. She thinks she sees her in the mirror. There's no one there. And then the friend walks through the front door.
Gotcha.
That's what they wanted. I wound up, I guess I've done 10 books for them now over the last two decades. And those are all the titles that start out haunted because they were a specific venue. As I explained to them when I talked to them about the series, I said, ghosts don't tend to haunt people. They haunt venues. And people walk into those venues. Hotels, haunted theaters, haunted cemeteries, and so on. Different types of venues.
When you book when you book a writing a book about haunted theaters or cemeteries, do you actually go to the theaters or the cemeteries or the highways or whatever it may be?
Not all of them. I try to. I go to the ones that are near me, of course. And I visited, when I wrote Haunted Hollywood, of course, I visited all of those.
Well, yeah, because you live right there.
But I don't go out. I don't go up and set a ghost hunt. Because that is not what these books are. Regurgitating, that's not a good word.
Yeah.
It's retelling.
I know what you mean.
It's retelling the legends. But here's
regurgitating the legends. Doesn't sound quite as good.
No. That's not good copy for the back cover.
Yeah.
These regurgitated legends.
Yeah.
Most of my work is to try to not verify, but to research whether or not the legend has any basis in fact. For instance, did that house even exist in the year that the ghost supposedly comes from? In my book on Washington, D.C., there's a house in Georgetown that is supposedly haunted by Thomas Jefferson's maid. Well, Jefferson never lived in that house. And I'll give the skeptical outs to them. yes, people are seeing lights, but then again, around the corner, there is a freeway. So I don't debunk them, but I do explain that there are, you can't just accept the legend.
Well, I wonder if you know anything about this. When I was touring Northern California, and I was in a city called Colma. I think that's how it's said, C-O-L-M-A.
What are you referring to? What?
Okay, well, I was in Northern California. So I look on this app, it's called Roadside America app. And it says that you can visit the Circus Show Folks of America Memorial. And what it is, it's in this city of Colma, where there are cemeteries everywhere. There's like a Greek Orthodox cemetery. There's a Italian cemetery, or there's this cemetery. There's a pet cemetery. So I go into this one place. I even wrote it down. Olivet Memorial Park. Inside of it, there was a giant tombstone that has a clown etched inside of it. It is called the Circus Show Folk of America Memorial. And it was dedicated to a 1918 train accident where 56 or so circus folk were killed.
Wait, that's not in California.
No, that was in Illinois.
Yes, yes. Oh, but you saw the memorial, a California memorial, an epitaph.
Exactly.
About the other one.
Right.
Yes, I do know about the other one, and I wrote it up in one of my books, Haunted Something or the Other. Yes, there was this terrible train accident, circus train accident. The last six cars got crushed. Many people died, and some circus animals. The Fans Association had recently bought a plot within that cemetery.
Oh, okay.
Here's the weird legend about the hauntings at that cemetery. There are, I think it's four, statues of elephants, not full size, but large statues of elephants, mm-hmm. at the four corners of what their plot is. People have claimed that they've heard the ghosts of the pachyderms howling or crying in the night, coming from the cemetery. But there are no elephants buried at that cemetery.
Oh, they're only the statues.
It's just statues.
Uh-huh.
The statues are there because elephants are associated with the circus.
Right.
It's one of those myths that took a life of its own.
I guess so. Do you have any other first-person accounts? People that told you stories that are interesting to you?
I've had one even within my own family.
Oh.
Well, he's now deceased, but my brother-in-law, Randy, when he was a teenager, he and his brother were playing around in their grandmother's room. She had passed away and was buried. She had always made it clear that when she died, she wanted to be buried with her rosary. She was a devout Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't find it when she died, so she was buried without it. Well, now, months later, they're playing in grandma's old room, and in the back of a dresser drawer, they found the rosary. Randy puts it over his head and says, "Look, I'm grandma." He said, now he would have been about 14 at the time, 13 or 14.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and immediately something grabbed the necklace from behind and jerked backwards. Not to try to kill him, but as if pulling it back, saying, "That's mine."
Uh-huh.
He took it off, threw it on the floor. Both boys ran out of the room. Didn't come back for a couple of hours, but they never played with the rosary again.
Yeah, I imagine.
There's that. My mother, on her deathbed, just days before she passed, would look at the end of the bed off into a corner of the room. And this was long before I was starting investigating ghost stuff. I said, "What are you looking at, Mom?" And she said, "Chuck." Now, that was my dad's name.
Mm-hmm.
There are many stories of people of spirits coming back to help ease the people's passage to the next world. In retrospect, I wish I had been savvy enough to ask her, Dad is here.
Yeah, what is he doing? What's going on?
Is that really what you mean?
Yeah.
You know, are you actually seeing him or are you thinking about him?
Yeah.
By the way, why there are so many magicians who are interested in the paranormal and the supernatural. But let's take the paranormal, the ghost stuff, the ESP stuff, and so on. Is that magic makes the impossible seem possible.
Yep.
That's what magic's about. It makes viewers open to that there are things possible that they had never dreamt of. It's only a step from there to saying, well, what else might be possible that we just toss off? Do children actually see their invisible friends? People do see apparitions. They feel them, they experience them, they sense them, but are what they feel the soul of a deceased loved one? That's another jump that you have to take. The fact that people are seeing things is not in doubt. It's interpreting what they're seeing and why they're seeing it. I mean, until someone actually comes back from the other world and says, hi, I'm here, I'm a ghost. Yeah. And everyone says, oh, hi there. It's all conjecture of what people are actually think they're seeing and experiencing.
As a magician, I think sometimes we're fascinated by that particular subject because we do know a few things about how we can make a ghost look, or how we can create a seance, or how we can do this, or how we can do that. So to take that leap to the next step of something that we don't understand.
As you know, one of the easiest types of people to fool are other magicians.
Because you know what they know.
You know what they know, so you just do it a different way.
Yeah.
And they don't think beyond the first method to a different method.
Yeah.
Oh, we're talking jargon here. But most magicians would not look for a second method if they have one way to do something successfully, because
sure.
It looks the same to the audience.
All right, we're going to move on to Factor, something John just made up, the Variety Artist's favorite game. Does that sound like fun?
That sounds like fun.
Oh, good. Let's do it.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
Ah. Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to say a headline, and you're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little more about it.
All right.
Here we go. First headline. Tom climbed to the top of the Great Pyramid of Giza.
Yes, I did.
Oh, tell me about that.
It's illegal to climb the pyramids. Let's say that. Let's start out with that.
Okay.
For two reasons. First of all, it's for safety. I can tell you from experience that going up is like climbing a ladder. You're just worried about getting up the next stone or rung in front of you. Mm-hmm. Looking down, however, the Great Pyramid looks vertical.
Oh, wow.
So people were falling down and hurting themselves. And also every time anyone climbs up it, it's going to erode some of the stones of these granite blocks and, don't want them to wear away. They know who wants to climb them because the signs that are bolted into the granite blocks say, in English only, It is forbidden to climb pyramid.
So do you think the people that put those signs on, they're like, oh, these Americans, they're the ones that are going to try to climb it?
Oh, of course. They're the only ones who are stupid enough to do it.
Were there guards or anything, or did you just start climbing?
There was a guy who was there, who is like one of the people that normally put you up on the camel and take your picture, you know, one of the vendors there.
Yeah.
It was closing time at the pyramid, so they were sending everybody off the grounds because they were going to start the light show later that night. He sees me, and I'm on the back side of the pyramids, staring up at it, and he comes over and says, you want to climb pyramid? And I said, it is forbidden to climb pyramids.
I read that in English.
And he said, no problem, and smiled. And I said, oh. Now, I had learned that at that time, anyway, you could buy pretty much anything you wanted in Egypt for the right price. Mm-hmm. And I had also learned how to haggle. You take all the money out of your wallet and you put in your wallet only enough money, the maximum that you're willing to pay for anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a $20 bill in my wallet. He said, no problem. I said, oh, how much? And he said, $50. Mm-hmm. And I opened my wallet and said, I have 20. And he said, okay. So
tough haggle.
He starts scrambling up the pyramid. Now you have to imagine the blocks of the pyramid are, of the Great Pyramid at least, are 3 feet high.
Okay.
2-3 feet high. So it's not like you're walking up, you're vaulting yourself, vaulting yourself mm-hmm. from each one to the next. Obviously he does this for a living. He's about halfway up. I've barely made it up 10 blocks. The guard on the ground with a machine gun starts waving his gun at me.
Great.
And I yell up to the guy above me, problem. And he looks down at the guy and says, no problem. Waves to the guard who turns and walks away. So obviously they were working together on this. And, you know, it was a stupid thing to do. It was, you should not do this. People don't do that. I'm saying to your listeners, when was I ever going to have the opportunity to do it again?
Yeah, don't say, Tom told me I could do this.
Yes.
All right, we're going to go to the next one. You ready for it, Tom?
Okay.
Tom was the only magician ever to perform in front of the Sphinx.
That's not true, I don't think.
As long as you were there.
I did do some magic for street kids there. No, I didn't do an actual performance there. I'm sure other magicians have. In fact, I know some have. Franz Ferrari did a special in Egypt.
Oh, yeah, that's right, huh? All right, we're going to go to the last one.
Okay.
Tom has over 2,000 autographed 8x10s from celebrities.
I do indeed.
Why do you have that?
Because I'm crazy. I'm an avid theater goer. Sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, I started standing at the stage doors to ask the stars to sign the playbills when they came out. I always felt that was legitimate. I had paid to see their show, and they had every right to say no, but I had a right to ask.
Sure.
And this was before eBay. It was before rabid autograph collecting, where people will hear, oh, they're in a restaurant, and they'll barge in and ask them in the middle of a meal, will you sign this napkin?
Yeah.
It was simpler times. I decided to move from playbills. After I moved to Hollywood, there are so many memorabilia stores here that I started buying an 8x10 glossy of them to get a photograph signed.
Mm.
And I would always take two because I would put them on a clipboard side by side. I started doing that after I found some wouldn't sign them just because they didn't like that photograph for some reason or the other. They didn't like that movie. That photo had not actually been released. It was, you know, off a back reel. Who knows? Faye Dunaway would not sign anything from Mommy Dearest.
Mm.
So I would take two, and that way also I could give one away if it was a friend's particular favorite star.
So there would be two different 8x10s.
So it'd be two different 8x10s, right. I saw a lot of theater, and I started going to a lot of book signings. They just accumulated over the 80s. When eBay started, it became a commerce. Guys would show up with a stack of 8x10s saying, sign this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and the stars knew they were going to be sold online the next day.
Oh, yeah.
So they stopped signing. The fun of signing was not the autograph. It was, they used to take the time to talk to you while they were signing.
Hmm.
especially if it was an interesting photo where they would say, oh, I've never seen that photo before. Or I remember that film when we did this so-and-so. It was fascinating. Here's, I remember Mel Blanc, you know, Woody Woodpecker, the man of a thousand voices.
Yeah, Bugs Bunny.
A photo, and Bugs Bunny, the photo that I took to him, he said, I've never seen that photo, and that kid in the photo is my son.
Hmm.
If I sign this, will you make a copy for me? And I said, I'll do you one better. If you promise to return it, I will make a copy of it before it's signed, and I'll send them both to you with a self-addressed envelope. Uh-huh. And that way you won't have your signature on a photo you want to keep of you and your son.
Yeah.
So you get those kind of stories. I was at a stage door in London, Peter O'Toole. There were only five of us standing at the stage door for Peter O'Toole's signature.
Wow.
Because that's not a thing at all, wasn't a thing at all in England, autograph collecting. That was gauche. So we, of course, were all Americans. He comes out semi-soused, as he was.
As he was all the time.
Even in the production I saw. But anyway.
Legend has it.
As he's signing my autograph, a bag woman comes by. She stops, sees the five of us and a guy signing something, and she looks up at him and says, are you famous? And he looks down at her and says, very, madam. And then she wanders off. Well, you know, that was what made it fun.
Well, that's neat. Now that, you know, you look through those photos now and you probably have a story for each one of them, 2,000.
And I started at a time that I was still able to get people like Jimmy Stewart and Betty Davis, because for them, autographs was part of their training in the studio system. And because they weren't getting thousands of fan letters, it was them doing it, not a secretary.
Mm.
For instance, one of the more interesting photos, that classic pose of Donald O'Connor, Debbie Reynolds, and Gene Kelly in the Slickers in Singing in the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
I have two copies of that photo, one in black and white, one in color, signed by all three.
Wow.
Which I personally collected.
Well, where are all those photos now?
Oh, I can't say, or the thieves will come.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Someone hears that, they go, oh, we'll just break into Tom's basement and grab those.
Yeah, that's where they are.
That was Fact. Or something John just made up.
We're going to do some fan questions. Every week I put on my Facebook group, the Variety Artist Community Facebook group, that you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. And here we go. Would you like some questions there, my friend?
Sure.
Okay. Matt DeCero, who is a friend of yours, I think.
Yes.
Get this. He's the unapologetic magic geek, freelance bacon scholar, infuriatingly humble magician and comedian out of Toronto, Ontario, says, I've known Tom my entire adult working life. His influence on comedy magic is often overlooked, but it was pretty tremendous. Armed with that information, I wonder if Tom feels happy about the state of comedy magic and where it's going with the newer generation.
First of all, now I owe Matt a check, I guess. Thank you. It's a different style of magic now. It's just as entertaining, but it is a different style. When I started doing a comedy magic, there were not a lot of us. Most magicians at that time were still in the pull a rabbit out of the hat mode.
Mm.
It was an act, not talking, set to music. Your goal was one day you would get a show in Vegas or do the 12-minute spot in a review show.
Mm.
Talking magicians were normally relegated to Rotary Club halls.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the person that really influenced that style of magic, comedy magic, most was not because of his work as a magician, but it was a Steve Martin.
Yeah.
And his wild and crazy persona allowed magicians to get a funny persona.
Mm-hmm.
The state of comedy magic today, it is what it is. It's just, I don't know. I don't have a comment to answer that as to how comedy magicians today are changing. I'm just glad it still exists.
Well, there you go, Matt. All right. Graham Rogers, a magician originally from New Zealand, who now lives in Phoenix, Arizona, says, one of the best lectures I've attended when he visited New Zealand many years ago in 1985. I think all the years later, I still use a routine from that lecture. He's talking about you. That wasn't even a question. He was just talking about your lecture.
I wonder which trick it is. Well, I think it would probably be the one that most people have taken from that particular lecture. By the way, for those who don't know, magicians often will go out and lecture to other magicians to teach their tricks or routines,
right,
or their points of view on things. And a routine that has been a staple of mine since I first learned the mechanics of the trick is a trick called Cards Across.
Mm-hmm.
In the lecture, I also included all of the comedy patter I use and the blocking. And that's a thing that a lot of performers don't think about. They worry about how the trick is done, but not the stage look. Am I wandering around the stage? If I have a volunteer from the audience standing next to me, can the audience on the right-hand side of see anymore, or is that guy blocking him?
Mm-hmm.
This has nothing to do with Graham's question and everything to do with it. Shortly after I moved to LA and started working at the Magic Castle, one of the regulars there came up to me and said, you need to take acting lessons, which I, of course, immediately took as an insult.
Uh-huh.
and said, truthfully, I know why. And he said, it will improve your magic 100%. It did. I didn't take lessons in learning how to pretend I was a tree.
Yeah.
It was all scene study.
Yeah.
Where I learned you don't have a prop there for no reason. How do you put something down and pick something else up at the same time in a single motion?
Mm-hmm.
All the blocking, the interaction, the things that make an act fluid, I learned while training for scene study in acting rather than in magic. Today, people can learn that themselves by videotaping their act and saying, oh my God, I turned my back 12 times, that sort of thing.
Brett Bolich, also known as Bretzo the Great, says, ask him about the ghost stories at the Magic Castle.
Oh my.
Yeah.
I'm working on a book about it right now. Yes, the Magic Castle, for those who don't know it, is a magician's clubhouse. It was started in 1963, January 2nd it opened. It is in a 1918 Victorian style, more of a French chalet style mansion,
mm-hmm,
that was sitting there abandoned, not abandoned, but just sitting there as an investment for the owner. A magic club was started in there just for magicians to have a place to hang out and do tricks for themselves and their friends.
Mm-hmm.
Started by Bill and Milt Larson back in the 60s. And it's still there. It is a private club. You can't just walk into it. You have to know a member to get inside.
Yeah.
And the building, according to many people, is haunted. And I've been collecting stories from servers, managers who have closed the place down, you know, at 2 a.m. that they're the last person there locking up. Rather than take time to talk about it, I have put together a video on it. You'll find on YouTube, go to YouTube and put in the search line, Ghosts of the Magic Castle, and you might add my name, Tom Ogden, just in case anyone else has posted anything about it there too. And you also get to see footage from inside the castle, because a lot of times they I had to get special permission to be able to film inside.
Oh, yeah. I know. I've been to the Magic Castle, and the first thing that all your magicians tell you, don't pull your phone out.
Yeah.
No photography.
A lot of the founding members were celebrities, and we still have many celebrity members and visitors. Cary Grant was a regular there. Mm. That's why we have a no photograph and no autograph rule at the Magic Castle. I do a sword through neck trick. Yeah. You put a stock around someone's neck and then shove a sword through it.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing a private party at the castle. I don't even remember what the record it was anymore, but some rock record was having its release party at the Magic Castle. I got a guy up to help me for this trick. It's a 3-4 minute comedy routine. And I get to a point in the routine, in the middle of the routine, where I say, just before I'm about to stick the sword through his neck, I say, oh, here I'm about to kill you and we haven't been properly introduced. My name's Tom. What's yours? And he said, Johnny. And it was an unmistakable voice. It was Johnny Depp.
Oh, my.
I said, oh, well, hi, Johnny. 1, 2, 3. It goes through and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
The reason I didn't recognize him is he had left 21 Jump Street, and he had just done the film with Marlon Brando, Don Juan DeMarcos.
Yeah.
Which is when he first had that mustache and goatee, which he still kept, and the long stringy black hair. I didn't recognize him. He didn't look like Johnny Depp. But as soon as I heard that voice and looked into the eyes, duh. So later that evening, I see him sitting at the main bar downstairs. And I go to him and say, Mr. Depp, thank you for helping me in the performance. I would not have invited you up, but I didn't recognize you because of the new look. And he said, that's okay. I saw that everyone was in good-natured fun and all of that, so I was happy to help. He leaves with his date, and all the other magicians come up to me and said, wasn't she beautiful? And I said, huh? They said, his date, Kate Moss.
Oh.
So she's sitting today. I didn't even recognize her. But you know that it's one of the wonderful things about the Magic Castle.
All right, last one. Tim Hainig, award-winning magician, speaker, and actor, asks, what's the number one piece of advice he would give for a stand-up comedy magic act?
This should be self-evident, but I would say work clean.
Hmm.
Can't say I would retire, but I would be much wealthier if I had a few dollars from the times that I've been told, oh, well, we're an adult group, you can make it R-rated. Hmm. Or, you know, it's just the guys, make it as dirty as you like. In fact, I was once booked on a cruise ship explicitly to do an adults-only triple X show.
Oh.
A midnight show. Problem is, I don't really work dirty. I can have suggestive lines. But the thing is, once you are known for doing any of that humor, people think that's all you do. And if the young magician is saying, well, or comedy magician is saying, well, I don't want to work kiddie birthday parties anyway. Yeah, well, Xerox may not want you using four-letter words with their clients either.
Right, or certainly Disney.
Or certainly Disney.
Yeah.
Although, I have a Disney story.
Okay, go!
I was working the Disney Cruise Line at that time. The magician did 3 different shows. They did a 12-minute set in the middle of the Welcome Aboard show, which would be the same as you doing 12 minutes in the middle of the Tropicana review show.
Mm-hmm.
You did a show just for the kids. But of course, what that really meant was you were doing it for the soccer moms who were drinking in the back with the 2-year-olds sitting on the floor. Mm-hmm. Because all the preteens and the teens have gone to their separate clubhouses.
Of course, because they're too cool.
Because they're too cool to come to a magic show.
Of course.
And an adults-only show in one deck that you have to be over 18 to go into.
Hmm.
a place for adults to get away from the kids.
Yeah.
And they wanted a show adult oriented. And I said to them at the time, when you say when you say an adult show, do you mean Miramax or Buena Vista? You know,
yeah.
Which you put movies out under different labels depending upon its adult content.
Right.
And they said, of course, well, I don't know. Do the show and we'll let you know. I wasn't what they wanted.
You weren't blue enough?
I wasn't blue enough. What they meant was they didn't want four-letter words.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you could be as suggestive as you wanted, but you couldn't be profane.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I saw that because my opening act on that show was a comic, and he started with a Viagra joke.
Mm.
And they just all laughed. But the problem was I was in a bind because I didn't have any material to do that.
Well, your material is your material. And if you start off with blue material, that's great. You know, you have the blue material, and if someone asks you for that material, great, you can do that. But to go from having material that is funny but not blue and asking you to change your material for this particular thing, that seems to be a lot to ask.
Another reason it's a lot to ask is because it's not going to be as strong as your regular material.
Right.
So you're not going to get as good of a show. But I can give a couple of advices beyond that, which are not specific to comedy magicians.
Sure. Yeah. It's just some general advice because we have so many different types of acts listening to this.
I'm old.
Is that your advice?
Yes. Start preparing for your retirement now.
Mm.
People do not want to see a 70-year-old juggler standing on a roll of bola, because they're going to be worried whether he's going to break his hip. Any performer, get ready so you can get to a point, like me, fortunately, that you can only perform when you want to.
Mm.
And so that you can do it comfortably. That's the point. And he wouldn't mind me telling the story because he tells it himself. Marvin Roy, who is a legend in magic.
Yes, Mr. Electric.
Mr. Electric, 96, I believe now, at least 94. Living outside of Palm Springs. He is in, not assisted living, but an adult community. He said the only reason he is still alive and able to afford to be alive, I should say, and live well, is because his wife, Carol, for all of the years before her passing, back when they were touring internationally, took 10% of every dollar they earned and put it aside.
Mm-hmm.
She said, back then you got paid in Europe, you got paid in cash at the end of the gig. He said she would sit on the bed at night and she would put all the money on the bed and she'd say, okay, that's the agent's commission. That's our retirement. We forget that that exists. The point is financial planning. If I had known when I was in college that I was going to be a full-time professional entertainer, I would have had a double major to add business classes. Business courses on budgeting, basic tax knowledge.
I know all sorts of advanced algebra, but I don't know how to do my taxes or do my shopping.
That's right. Mind you, I have an accountant do my taxes too, but.
How about one recommended book and we'll get you off here? Gee, do you have any books that you can possibly recommend?
Well, maybe I could recommend one of mine.
Oh.
Although you will have to buy it used because it's now out of print, but it's widely available online.
Which one is that?
I am still very, very proud of my Complete Idiot's Guide to Magic Tricks.
Mm.
And the reason I am so proud of it is the book I wish I had had when I was starting magic at 14, because it's not just tricks. the opening five or six chapters are how to write patter, how to develop a personality, how to get on and off a stage, all the theater parts of being a performer.
Well, what I'll do then is I'll put that book on my website so someone can click on that. And in fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put a bunch of your books on my website. So if somebody's interested in getting some of those, they can just click on there and go straight to Amazon.
I'll tell you my next book to come out, though.
Go ahead.
I have a new book coming out in August or September called Spooky Trails and Tall Tales, California. It is haunted hiking trails in California.
Ooh.
It's by Falcon Guides, who for decades have done hiking maps, atlases, and everything to do with backpacking.
That'll be fun. When is that out?
It was fun. It'll be out in August or September.
Shoot me out a message and I'll put that on my website so someone can just click on that one too.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for doing my show. That was fun, man.
And thank you. This was fun.
That was. I learned a lot in this podcast, in this interview. Now, before I let you go, do you have any social media?
Probably just basically my website, which is tomogden.com.
Okay.
I don't have the ghost website up yet, but I do have a Facebook page on it. So it's Facebook.com/theghostguy.
By the way, I went on there and I watched some of the videos on there, and there's some really cool videos. So if you all get a chance, take a look at that Facebook page, watch some of the videos. Really, really fun.
It's a never-ending fascination for me, the subject of ghosts and hauntings.
Well, first, thanks to you, Tom, for hanging out with me for a little while. Thanks to all my Variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, spread the word. That's how we can grow this thing. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist. But your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.